So first, I just want to hear if you have questions or anything to say. Feel free. How's that going?
It's been such a long time since I've meditated, and prior to this, it's all going through this meditation.
Yeah.
So I'm struggling with the lack of what, like comparing the two.
Yeah.
But being the other was so prescriptive.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm in the wilderness a bit.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to just work with that and hope that just by accepting what you have to say at the end of the journey, benefits will be there.
Yeah.
And I can already see it, but I can sit here, my legs crossed.
Yeah. That's good, because I wouldn't want you to just accept what I say and then kind of hope for the best. If you already see benefits in 24 hours, then. If I may say, Karen was happy. She didn't have to sit even once, so she's sitting. Yeah. Also, I can always tell you something to do if you get desperate. I mean, and I have also. I just didn't do it in that way. I've said two main things. One is contact with the ground. And in case a feeling of receptivity comes that feels good, then that can be what we immerse into. In case that doesn't happen, which is 90% of the time probably, sound, body, out-breath. But because I'm not telling you what to do, and this is the only way, etc., it's very challenging. So, as an artist, I know you can enjoy challenge. So, of finding your own, discovering your way.
So, you're not giving me anything to rebel against.
Yeah, sorry. That's very precise, because I've given you, I have been prescriptive, but not in that way. Great. Anyone else? Anything else? You might rebel against Wendell Berry by tomorrow. I keep bringing him.
I find that I'm falling asleep.
Yeah.
So often. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of kind of down from sleep.
Yep. That's right. That's good. You're tired. Yeah.
I remember one time in India, I started a whole retreat. 10 days.
Usually around this evening or so, especially if we didn't have the chance to talk about it, you might start to feel rebellious against sleeping so much. Like, I'm wasting my time, I could do this at home. And so the first response is that you can't do it at home, because you never have, unless you were sick. Some excuse would be there, then you would sleep and sleep.
Yeah. I decide not to sleep all the time. It's
right.
Very hard for me.
Yeah.
But because I feel like sleeping all the time.
Yeah. With jet lag, the best experiment that I've heard of, because coming this way and it's a long way, it hits hard, really. So the best experiment that I've heard with jet lag is to get up with the sun, no matter what. And even if you do take a little nap in the afternoon, the important thing is to get up with the sun. And there, it does make sense sort of scientifically for the how the brain gets your cycle tuned to where you are. So that's one option. Don't worry about it too much, except for if you can get up in the morning and be up for a few hours.
no problem to get up.
Yeah.
I have problems to stay awake.
Yeah.
And to sleep.
Yeah. So I'm just saying it's just a side practical issue for jet lag. Yeah. And then otherwise it takes a couple of days. When did you arrive?
3 days ago.
Okay. You'll start to be on.
Yeah. I guess my question around the sleeping is around, because I feel like I get enough sleep in my life. Mm. It's more around, is that a form of laziness?
Mm. Yeah. No, I think that is the question about sleeping and doing nothing. Is it laziness? So, because I didn't actually respond yet to your question either, so that we can bring it together.
Sorry, what was it?
She says she gets enough sleep, and so she wonders how much sleeping is and laziness are the same. Is that a good summary? So some people don't get enough sleep, and so they're even more tired. Some people do maybe get, like on paper, the right number of hours of sleep. But then when we're awake and when we're asleep, is there restfulness? Is there ease? Is there a feeling of being at home on the planet? Is there a sense that there is okayness already first, or do I have to earn it? Do I have to be busy in order to be allowed to be here kind of feeling? So sometimes that might be really subtle in someone, and sometimes it might be really on and in your face. But that is pretty much how the culture goes, is that occupation is the way to earn your right to be. And also, it goes the other way around, that if you are occupied enough and well enough, then you will have the things that people are supposed to want to have, which is also, it's not exactly so black and white, is it? Some people work hard and are really well-intentioned and do good work, and they don't get recognition or money, etc. And so we kind of cut our wings on both sides with that ideology. So we're not actually talking so much about hours of sleep, exactly. We're talking about the inner state, sleeping or awake. And how is it? Can we trust ourselves and our life to be active and creative and fully alive, not because of pressure or fear? So there could be pressure and fear sometimes, but that's not our motivation for doing things at every second. So we've become, most of us have become habituated to that. We'll go back up even a little bit more. In our subtle experience, there isn't really much to hold on to, even our most solid experiences like the body. So we played yesterday evening with this contact with the ground, okay, that as a fact. It would be hard to argue with the fact that we have contact with the ground. And yet the experience of contact with the ground, exactly what is it? And exactly even where is it sometimes? So I don't know about you, but for me, I can kind of say like here, there's some contact with the ground, but it doesn't even feel like it's limited to a little pancake of skin cells. It feels about this big. So that's already different from my idea of contact with the ground. The experience of contact with the ground being different from my idea of contact with the ground. So if we start to notice our experience experientially, which means letting go of relating to things always through the idea, the experience, I haven't found an experience that's graspable yet. They're vivid, they're intense, or they're subtle, and intense, but not graspable. Hardly describable. So one, even just for 10 seconds. How many pages to describe that? And then instead of accepting our experiences like that, impossible to say definitively, impossible to know definitively if I exist or do not exist even. Instead of starting with that ground of experience, by our training, we had an invitation in our education that we accepted to think something must be wrong. Because things do look solid. People do look separate from each other. You look, I can easily think that you fit inside your skin. And so then we start from that assumption that doesn't match our experience, and we're lost. We start from the assumption that there should be something solid and contained and limited. That is me, and that is you, and that is the ground. And then it isn't solid and contained and limited. Sometimes it does act that way, and that's completely fine. We have our ways of being somewhat separate. We're not trying to say we're absolutely a smoothie. But we then forget our actual experience and try to operate from not our experience, but what we think should be, what we've accepted should be. And operating from should means from pressure, from not okayness, which is fear. But especially what it is nothing to really work with that's actually real. And so there's a constant occupation. There's a constant movement from fear, from not okay, from not quite right, from almost there but not quite. And then we forget that there could still be a kind of movement that happens another way, not from fear. From accepting the kind of huge and kind of ordinary experience that I don't know if I exist or not. That I'm kind of solid and kind of not. That I'm kind of limited and kind of not. That I'm partly visible and partly not. So that's sort of what deep rest is starting to check out, if maybe there's another way of movement, another kind of stillness that isn't just running out of batteries or trying to enforce with tension because I should be still. And from there, even your sleep will be different, and you may need less sleep even. And that happens to be partly what I want to talk about today. Is that good enough for now about your question? Okay. Is there any other question before we go into what I have on my paper?
So when you gave instruction about sound, and I started to...
Maybe a little louder.
When you gave instruction about sound, and I started to not listen, but just...
Mm-hmm.
I had that experience of suddenly that I wasn't other than the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And for brief moments, I almost knew a second before the sound happened that mm-hmm. it would happen. And that I, whatever the I-ness was participating in the mm-hmm. sound. But then it got scary.
Yeah.
And the sense of the boundary was too wide, and then kind of this mm-hmm. Internal tension of...
Yeah.
And so much. By the end of the sit, quite a lot of physical pain.
Yeah.
So trying to find that kind of enjoyed that experience, but it brought up so much mm-hmm. fear and tension and wanting to go back at it. And it just,
yeah,
it was quite confusing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's at least let it be not confusing. I think hearing you speak, it's very clear. It's not confusing at all. We're habituated to be confused, to fear, and to trying, and to not feeling okay. And so we replace a natural okayness, instead of the natural okayness that is possible, is available, we have gotten used to, we can't even call it second best. a default mode of not okay, but pretending to be in control or seeming to be in control, something like that, or trying to be in control. Being occupied with controlling and never getting it. So we're not used to joy, and we're not used to feeling belonging and at home, and how vast life is. And so, just like any other addiction, our addiction to not okay and try to control, so our addiction to occupation, just takes some time. And naturally, terror will come in the face of real experience. So it's kind of like, even if it's terror and panic, it's kind of like also no big deal, of course. In the face of death, however good our philosophy about death is, or even we may have some friendliness with death through experience, even so, there's some momentum towards hating it, thinking that it really is the end of something that we wish we could have, that we think we need, we must have. So I'd like to call this talk Towards a Culture of Praise. One of the things that we reach towards to try to feel okay, we think it's going to make us feel okay, and sometimes it does, is to get praise. And that's not what I mean. We already have a culture that reaches towards some kind of recognition. Some people get recognition through the negative, but most of us would rather have praise. But what about the experience of like a state of praise, a state of praising? A way of living where it doesn't matter so much what the conditions are. It is a beautiful life. There's a woman named Etty Hillesum who was Jewish in Holland at that wrong time. And she actually would go to one of the concentration camps before she was put in it to bring like food and medicine and clothes to people who were already in it. And then she was living in it as well. And there was like mud and chain link fence, and people were sick and everything. And she would look through the chain link fence and found what life was beautiful. So it's just to say I'm not being flip. I'm not just saying, oh, it's so beautiful. Personally, I've had one of the hardest years of my life, and I'm surprised to feel in my system again and again this, what a beautiful life, happening. life is beautiful. We are highly attuned to what's wrong. That's what we practice. And whatever our personality mode is, whether it's maybe we're into complaining, or maybe we're into fixing, or whatever. But we tend to be oriented around what's wrong. And there is so much that is wrong. We can just, even if it's a cultural construct, etc., it's wrong. It's terrible. It's true. But also, it's a beautiful life. And our practice can design itself. Our practice can emerge from our very lives. It can make its own way, make its own shape. That our practice is becoming highly attuned to the beauty in life. That's not to say life as opposed to death. It's life that includes, obviously, sitting here next to a pile of some kind of shit, maybe probably cow shit, that is dying, becoming earth, sacrificing itself for the grass, for the cow, etc. So part of a poem called A Standing Ground by Wendell Berry. However just and anxious I have been, I will stop and step back from the crowd of those who may agree with what I say and be apart. So I'm using this word culture, and so often what culture does is like cultural pressure. We tend to want to conform. So even walking in the line together, it's something that we can play with. Like we start to follow the rhythm of the person in front of us, or we rebel against that. That so often is our like only two options that we're aware of having. And Anton luckily gave us another option, which was to feel the whole group, which we did. I think it was interesting as we started to move, probably just coincidence, but the response of the cows was interesting. It was as if it was responding to one big thing that was us, maybe. And they weren't sure, like they weren't exactly afraid, but they got energy. So there is something about culture that is collective that we could tune into without leaving ourselves. And sometimes we could just take the moment of just being apart from even those who may agree with what we say. So that it's not just about agreeing and feeling, oh yeah, yeah, me too, confirming each other's opinions. But letting it be confirmed from below, as if from below, from aliveness, that we are together. And we are different and also not. And that there can be possibly room for all of that. So I just like how he starts the poem. However just and anxious, putting those two words together, I have been. I will stop and step back from the crowd of those who may agree with what I say and be apart. There is no earthly promise of life or peace, but where the roots branch and weave their patient, silent passages in the dark. Uprooted, I have been furious without an aim. And then he just talks about how he's not looking for some big destiny. And at the end he says, better than any argument is to rise at dawn and pick dew-wet red berries in a cup. So this line, uprooted, I have been furious without an aim.
What was that again,
sir? Uprooted, I have been furious without an aim. So it's curious also, he doesn't necessarily say, and we don't have to agree with him even if he does say, that we need to have an aim. We may or may not need to have an aim, but to be uprooted, furious, without an aim. Is what we have been. We have all experienced that, I think. And with or without an aim, to find ourselves up at dawn picking dew-wet berries into a cup. We've also experienced, in some way, it might be different kinds of berries and cups and time of day. If we could listen to the poem and the image of the roots. No earthly promise of life or peace, but where the roots branch and weave their patient, silent passages in the dark. So for him, it might mean that he does need to be by plants and trees, literally. But for us, we have a wider spread. It may be that a human body being does need to be around things with roots in the ground sometimes. That might be true. But somehow what we definitely need is to feel when our roots are in the ground what happens. So, and what is a root? It's okay, it'll change. Thank you. There are a couple things about roots that are important. They're in the dark.
Strength.
They're not seen.
Strength.
They give strength, yeah. They give strength for what?
Sustenance, nourishment.
Yeah. So they give strength because nourishment happens through roots. That's where nourishment happens. It's the main way. Nourishment can happen through leaves a little bit, but mostly through the roots. Nourishment, including water, including minerals, including energy. In the dark, underground. And that strength partly translates in being uplifted and having a steadiness. Steadiness partly through flexibility and partly through what we would just call good old strength. So we can be open, especially in these days together on the retreat, to just feel what nourishment feels like when it happens. It might not be even 1 second of what's called the retreat that you feel nourishment. It might be everything but that. It might be all of the background and none of the foreground of what we're doing. Not any single instruction, not any single formal meditation, etc. That you have full permission to feel where you feel nourishment, as you feel it, just to be open to that impression freely. Partly so that we can get to know each one of us, what is the nourishment, where and when, and what. But especially so that we can get, in a nonverbal way especially, what it feels like when nourishment comes about. Okay? Does that make sense? Because the main thing we want is to learn and recover our ability to recognize nourishment's happening. Roots are in the ground, and they're in touch with what's needed. And it's good. That's the basic thing. It's good. It's not like right as opposed to right wrong. It's just good. It's a standalone good. It's so good that it's scary, as Melissa gave an example. And that's just to be accepted for now. Another interesting thing about roots is being in the dark. And so just reflecting on the word culture and what culture is. What is culture? So the word culture is related to cult, like as in religious cult, and also cultivate, like digging the ground, which is a whole interesting thing. Digging the ground to grow something. Trying to improve the soil by disturbing it. So obviously, there could be ways of disturbing the soil, even with the best of intentions. I want to grow some good food here, so I'm going to disturb, like what must have happened here. I'm going to take out a bunch of trees to make a clearing. Right? Almost certainly. More than once. In the same way, culture, per se, culture, just culture, isn't necessarily beneficial, even if it has somehow like good intentions. We need to feel that culture is something we contribute to as well as are influenced by. We are shaped by it and we shape it. And so we could really be in touch with the bare bones of how culture makes an impression on you. And what are the ways that are beneficial there? And what are the ways that culture impacts on you that are not beneficial for you as an individual person, for your friends as individual people? And then also, sure, generally, what do you notice? What's your impression? So feeling that confidence, culture is made by people and you're a person. Culture is a living thing that can change because it's made by people. And then it has already changed in our lifetimes. It's changing today. So being aware of how actively we are creating culture as well as receiving it can help us be more interested. And even sometimes, like with strenuous effort, to pull away from some of those momentums, or even with strenuous effort sometimes, to pour energy into some new streams of culture. And then, okay, what is culture though? And what I found in the different cultures I've spent time in is it's a lot about food. And sometimes it's about when food happens, when do you eat? Of course, it's about what do you eat. It's really nice when it's about what do you eat at which time of year, if there's that much subtlety left, if it's not just a bulldozer kind of situation. And it's also about our relationship to light and dark, isn't it? So just it seems like a small thing, a minor detail. And it's related to when we eat and what we eat. How we relate to light and dark. When is sleep allowed? And when is awakeness allowed? So just the tuning into the right place and time. For us, what we mean is tuning into when it feels good to eat what, and when it feels good to be with the light, when it feels good to be with the dark. There are some really nice recent studies about sleep. And just one small one is people trying to figure out the correlation between higher rates of breast cancer and people who do night shift. So especially women who do night shifts. And so it's related to the whole jet lag thing as well. Being around blue light, which is the light of 10 o'clock in the morning, all night, just doesn't allow the body to release and clean itself the way it would with sleep that happens without blue light at night, without daytime kind of lighting during the night. And they're still trying to figure out why breast cancer. They're still trying to figure it out. But part of it is that there's not the natural cleaning that happens when there's rest in the dark. And part of it seems to be that the bodies have lost touch with a rhythm, and so eating happens out of rhythm, and eating happens in the night. So not only obesity, not only a good 20% extra body weight happens, but also a tendency towards cancer in certain areas. So feeling our way towards a more life-giving, life-nourishing way of living, way of making a mark that might actually bring more nourishment. Another thing about culture is celebration. When do we celebrate? What do we celebrate? So just, I want to invite you during these days together not only to feel what it feels like when there is nourishment, when you feel nourished. So I'm saying completely subjectively, but you feel nourished. It's not that you feel confirmed or recognized or you got praise, you got put up so that you can fall down. There was nourishment. And a feeling of celebration, a feeling of praise. Another Wendell Berry poem called The Lilies. Amid the gray trunks of ancient trees, we found the gay woodland lilies nodding on their stems, frail and fair, so delicately balanced on the air, so delicately balanced the air held or moved them as it stood or moved. The ground that slept beneath us woke in them and made a music of the light as it had waked and sung in fragile things unnumbered years, and left their kind no less symmetrical and fair for all that time. Does my land have the health of this, where nothing falls but into life? So the language is a little bit difficult in one hearing. Did you catch it pretty much, or? I saw recently a documentary about the first people on this land. And some, maybe, I think maybe 35,000 years ago, there was a land bridge to Tasmania. And so people went for the first time that far south, as far as we know, on the planet, walking. You could walk apparently from Melbourne to Hobart And they did. Not that there was a Melbourne or a Hobart. And there's one place that was sheltered and still is sheltered from rain and from moisture. And therefore, the mark of all of those thousands of years of people living in the same place. Not just sort of like centuries, and not even like thousands of years, but tens of thousands of years in the same place. It just feels like in the poem. We think of that, we still so easily would think of it as primitive. And if we think rather of the sophistication involved in living somewhere that could still sustain life 25,000 years later for people of a somewhat different related culture.
What was the last line?
Of the poem. I'll read up a little bit before that and back down to that. The last line is, "Does my land have the help of this, where nothing falls but unto life?" So he's feeling how delicate the flowers are and how intimately responsive with the air and how the ground that slept beneath us woke in them and made a music of the light. As it had done for unnumbered years. And despite all of those years, the ground, the light, had left their kind, so especially the ground he's speaking of, had left their kind, had left the lilies, no less symmetrical and fair. So there hadn't been like a kind of wear and tear on the lilies. They hadn't gotten a little bit burdened for all that time. So it may be that we need, so as a need, not like as a should, but as an actual intrinsic need, we may need to be in touch with that kind of numberlessness, measurelessness, immeasurableness, immeasurability. And let that, from that immeasurability, that unnumberable, in, what did he say? Unnumbered years. From that sense of life that is beyond birth and death, there's a different kind of continuity. That we can tap into as a human being. And we can let that lead into our lives and through our lives. Let that be where our roots reach into. Unseen into the mystery, the roots weaving and branching. So that we could live that lightly, that we lose track of time and recover, uncover that responsiveness, like the lilies and the air. Sometimes still, sometimes moved. That is exquisite to experience, if sometimes terrifying. Can you kind of get beyond the poem to what may be in the poem and in your experience about power that also needs that vulnerability, that responsiveness, that thin-skinnedness, like a lily? That's what has the possibility of going unnumbered years, of linking what in us is beyond death and birth and fully present now and now and fulfilling in itself, even if it may sometimes have also an aim. And may sometimes not have an aim. So if we can feel the difference between being uprooted, furious, without an aim, the way we do, like just we're kicking and screaming, and it doesn't help us one bit. It could help that same release of energy if we were being met in some way, if we let ourselves also be met in some way. Then it could be that we need to kick and scream. And that would help. It could be, sometimes. Or it may be that being met, there's not kicking and screaming. Because what is missing is not missing. So feeling the difference between being uprooted, furious without an aim. And being aimless in the sense that we don't need to be occupied. We don't need to pour our whole energy into one small aim. There could be aims that emerge. And so one last bit of a poem for the day, I think. It's a poem that is called To a Siberian Woodsman. And in parentheses, part of the title is After Looking at Some Pictures in a Magazine. Which is very sweet and poignant. If we think of this may have been written in the 60s, how much the culture has changed already. It might be pictures in a magazine now, but it more likely would be something else, like internet or a week getaway to Siberia to do woods crafting or something and get a diploma or whatever. But it feels like in the overall poem that it's sort of Cold War time. It's a U.S. poet. And so he says, he feels into what the life of that person might have been, might maybe was, in his home with his family, at ease. And then he says, and I'm here in Kentucky, one of the states in the southeastern United States, and his contentment in his home. Different but same, two different cultures. But a kind of resonance between the two. A kind of hum on two sides of the planet that co-responds, coordinates. And then in the fourth section of the long poem, he says, who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who has armed us against each other with the death of the world? So nuclear war, etc. He's bringing it out in the poem. But that's not my main point in this poem, in reading this poem, just to give you the context. And I especially want to help us apply the poem very intimately in ourselves, as well as interpersonally, like in the one-to-one. Who has invented our enmity? We try to be friendly, but we're not. We're defensive. Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? We might not always experience it as hatred, there might be other words that are more appropriate, more apt during the day, during the course of the day. But we're mostly not in tune with how we're different, but there's a resonance in my hum and your hum. Mostly because of our insecurity and assuming that there is something wrong, and that is of primary importance, like we spoke of in the beginning. Who has prescribed enmity? And so when we talk about a culture of praise, it could start with oneself. Not like putting myself up and feeling like I'm better than, like that's the kind of praise that we think of as praise. But a state of praising, life is beautiful, including this, that I tend towards hating, that I tend towards being ashamed of. So including this and including that. And then in the section 5, the next section, he says, I sit in the shade of the trees of the land I was born in. As they are native, I am native. So it doesn't mean that you have to first find out and go back to where you were born and get a farm going there. But tuning in to when you happen to feel belonging, whatever situation, whatever context, or lack of context, but the feeling of belonging to start to be recognizable and welcome. The feeling that you can't not belong. The feeling of not belonging doesn't kick you out. It's not enough to mean that you don't belong. Even if you feel it, even if in your bloodstream is the chemical experience of not belonging. It doesn't take you out of the soup of life. It doesn't make you less organically part of us. So just like in the body this morning we explored, for example, the heart, and we could maybe feel how the tissue of the heart, the cells of the heart, as they have a certain function, so they also have a certain kind of quality that comes, that radiates or that fills us when we tune into it. So it's not to say that the heart isn't different from the lungs and the ribs and the skin and so on, or even the other muscles nearby. But it isn't also, it so obviously isn't separate or separable. And so part of coming into our own culture, our own rhythm of nourishment, when and what is nourishing, and with whom, where. Is to feel within ourselves, what are the different organs, what are the different forms, how do they relate, and what are the primary organs? There are some we can do without and some we can't. And similarly, outside of ourselves, in our daily lives, and also more widely, collectively, culturally, what is primary? What is essential for life to go on? What is essential for nourishment of aliveness in our lives? What is less important, but sure is good to have a gallbladder if possible? So he sits in the shade of the trees of the land he was born in. We have our own land that we start to discover and feel and recognize, like in our system, yes. Here I am. We start to notice that we're allowed to be first. And then there can be, of course, the difficulty. And the last line of the stanza I'm skipping, where he's looking around at the trees and seeing that they're not proclaiming any opinion or ideology. They don't have a flag on top of them. They have not declared to whom they stand in welcome. So why don't we end with the bell there and have a few minutes quiet before we walk down the hill. May we let our roots meet and be met by ground and groundwater. So that living has its beauty first. So that we meet ourselves and each other, praising primarily, so that we're lifted up by the goodness of living apart and together. May our practice and our lives and our willingness or determination to let life live fully through us, may that be part of a momentum towards liberation for all.